Ahoy.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Policy Voices by Friends of Europe, an independent think tank with a difference. Each week from Brussels, we bring you powerful conversations with policy voices from around the world. Policy Voices talking policy choices.
Anti-immigrant parties are successful in constituencies that have low immigration levels. So very often, it's people who don't have immigrants in their communities who vote anti-immigrant. Why is that? That is because the parties, the media, everybody talks a lot about immigration. You somehow convince people that all their problems are about immigration. And then, of course, you send them straight to the arms of the far-right parties that own the issue and therefore are the ones seen by the voters as credible.
Hello and welcome to Policy Voices, Friends of Europe's weekly podcast on European and global affairs. I'm your host, Caterina Villanova. If recent elections in the Netherlands, Slovakia and Portugal taught us anything, is that the far right is making serious gains across the continent and is a force to be reckoned with. With only 2 months to go before the entire Union heads to the polls, we at Friends of Europe felt that it was necessary to dedicate some time to this movement. Yes. We understand the rise of the far right as a threat to democracy itself. Yes, we believe it should be fought. And that is why we are bringing you a three-part series on the rise of the far right across Europe starting today. In today's episode of Policy Voices, I'm joined by Daphne Alicchiopolo, chair in comparative politics at the University of York and an expert on the far right. In the next 30 minutes, we condense Daphne's life's work as we answer the question, how did we get here? Perhaps more ominously, are we back to where we were a century ago? So if you ever wonder the same, and I'm sure you did, don't go anywhere and stay on that side to hear my conversation with Daphne Alicchiopolo, professor at the University of York. Hello, Daphne, and welcome to Policy Voices. Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. How are you today?
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me. I'm well, thank you. And I really look forward to having this chat with you about the far right in Europe.
So at Friends of Europe, we've been tackling the rise of the far right in specific countries last year with the right, with the win of Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. More recently in Portugal, where my home country, we saw 50 members of parliament entering parliament in as many years of democracy. But at Friends of Europe, we've been discussing amongst ourselves that there's something much bigger at play here. So we wanted to focus on the rise of the far right across the continent in Europe, keeping in mind that the elections and European elections are taking place in a few months from now. And for the first episode, we are very happy that to have you speaking with me today, as we will try to answer the question, how did we get here? It's a big question. We'll try to condense your life's work in 20 to 30 minutes. It's a big ask, but so here we go. Starting from the beginning, what would you say were the first signs of this wave, of this rise of the far right? Where and when did you start picking up on it?
Yeah, thanks so much. This is a really good question because I think I'm getting a lot of, as I said earlier, a lot of interest and many organizations are interested or concerned about the rise of the far right. And we have this tendency to present it as a sort of very new thing. So the first thing I want to say is that indeed there are new elements to it. And indeed this trend has proliferated, but this isn't actually new. So, you know, if we look back, we can still see, I mean, you know, but Pim Fortuyn, if you like, in some ways the predecessor of Geert Wilders, you know, did really well quite a long time ago. The FPÖ in Austria was in a coalition government a long time ago. In 2002, Jean-Marie Le Pen made it to the second round of the French presidential election. So it's not that we didn't have any indication that there was some kind of far-right performing well in certain elections. But what is new is that this trend has intensified, I'd say, quite a lot since the 2014 European Parliament elections and in a series of national elections that took place in 2017 and afterwards. We've seen an upward trend in many countries. I mean, you said you are from Portugal. You know, if we were having this chat 10 years ago, I would have told you about how Portugal and Spain were completely exceptional cases that had economic crisis and had certain ripe conditions, but didn't didn't have the far right.
That didn't last long.
Yes, exactly. That didn't last long. Or how some countries like Sweden had the cordon sanitaire, where they completely didn't let, you know, the far right into the political system, really. And that's not happening anymore. So we do see this rising trend across Europe. But I'd say what's also new and quite important is not simply the electoral performance of these parties, but also, secondly, the fact that many more of them are now in government. And this is newer, right? So you see them govern either alone or in coalitions in a series of European countries. So Italy, Hungary, until recently Poland, a number of Scandinavian countries. So increasingly, these parties are in government. They're able to implement policy, to make policy. And also, by extension, what we're also seeing that's quite new is now that they're kind of driving the rest of party competition. So what I mean by that is, even in the countries where they're not in government, they are actually the credible opposition partner. And in many ways, the other parties in the system are kind of thinking, well, the far right must have something there, right? They must be doing like something right. They must have this winning formula that makes them win elections. Therefore, in order to compete with them, we need to become them. We need to copy them. So we're seeing in many ways a shift of the party system to the right and an adoption of their policy agenda by other parties. And so I think this is really the big issue, right? Not only that we're seeing an intensified trend in terms of electoral performance, but also the increased ability of these parties to implement policy and their increased entrenchment into European party systems.
Can we then speak of causes? You look at both the supply and the demand of the far right parties across Europe. Can we then pinpoint a few causes that are relevant across the continent?
Absolutely. So I think, let me start by saying that obviously far-right parties, you know, are the owners of the immigration issue. And so since their emergence and then increasing successful electoral performance, there's been a lot of discussion, especially on the media, about how this is a sort of a value phenomenon, a value-driven phenomenon based on immigration. And what I do want to say in this podcast today is that my research does not, you know, kind of debunks that a bit and focuses on the more multifaceted dimension of the causes, right? So which is a demand and supply overall explanation, if you like. So I think in a nutshell, what is happening is at the demand side level, which is, you know, the people, the things that happen in society that change people's preferences, right? We see that there are multiple insecurities that drive voters to support the far right. Some of these are cultural / value based. Some are not. Some are also economic, welfare driven, driven to a series of other concerns, existential concerns, if you like, you know, ability to access housing, ability to access social services. What we've done in our research is we've actually distinguished between the core far right voters, who are driven by ideology. And these are voters essentially driven by cultural concerns. So these voters believe that immigrants may erode the country's national culture, their values, etc.
Is this there where also women's rights come into play, rights for the LGBTQ plus community, reproductive rights? Can you also put them in the same bag, let's say, as people that have these concerns about immigrants and refugees?
I guess it's complicated because I'll tell you why that is in a minute. Actually, when it comes to the women's issue, it becomes even more complicated. Give me a second and I'll get to you with that. But back to the cultural concern. So you have these voters who are concerned that immigrants erode their country's values. They have quite conservative values and quite nationalistic values, if you like. So these voters are ideologically attached to the far right. They condone the far right agenda. They vote for the far right because they support it ideologically. However, if we look at the pool of the far right electorate, we see that these are quite a small share. So in other words, they can't give these parties the 20%, 30%, 40% that they're getting in these European electorates. So we need to go beyond and look at the far-right what we call peripheral voters. These are voters that are driven by discontent. They are not loyal to the far right. They don't vote for the far right because they're ideologically attached to it. They vote for the far right because somehow they are against, it's a vote of protest against the others, against the mainstream that they used to vote for that they think has failed them, that has they think has breached the social contract, has not delivered on its social contract obligations. These voters tend to have significant economic concerns. They either, for example, have been convinced that immigrants are competitors in the labor market and they take away their jobs, or they have concerns, for example, they live in rural areas and have concerns that green environmentalist policies basically erode their livelihood, right? And they incur further costs on them that they don't want to pay, for example. So these voters are quite economically driven, or they distrust institutions. There's a range of voters with such concerns. And they are the majority of the far-right voter pool, right? So instead of thinking of the far-right supporter as one monolithic voter, we should see that there are multiple groups who vote for the far-right for their own reasons, right? Core voters, ideological, nationalistic, peripheral voters, protest voters, discontent voters vote against rather than for. So at the demand side level, multiple insecurities. Then on the supply side level, what you have is parties that are very clever and have developed their agendas in a very successful manner. So they've really shed the stigma of fascism. And if you look across Europe, you'll see that there's very few of them that would actually blatantly say we are, you know, we believe that the people of different color are inferior, we need to exclude them from society. They would never, this would not fly, except in extremely narrow circumstances, like in Greece during the economic crisis, where we had the Golden Dawn. But they do something instead, which is quite smart. They say, well, we are the defenders of our culture, of our country's liberal democratic values. We are the bastions of liberal democracy, and we exclude those who do not tolerate our liberal democratic beliefs. Geert Wilders, for example, in the Netherlands is a perfect example of that, right? So they're specifically against Muslim communities and specific groups, right, that they present as intolerant. There's a lot of variation here. This is very much done in Western Europe and specifically countries like the Netherlands, to an extent, France. You know, if you look at, for example, how the now Rassemblement National discusses terrorism, right? It used to be on very ethnic grounds. Now they say, obviously, they present, you know, all Muslims as potential terrorists and potential criminals that threaten the country. So they posit a narrative that's much more difficult to combat, which takes me to the women's issue that you mentioned before. This is tricky, because this way they could also potentially attract women and also feminist women, because they would say, you know, I don't want these intolerant Muslims who need to wear a burqa or not allow us to drink alcohol or eat pork, you know, for example. These are backward, you know, not anti-feminist ideas. If you're familiar with the AfD campaign in 2017, I don't know if you are, where they had these posters with the bikinis, with German ladies wearing bikinis, for example, and saying, well, we want to go to the beach and wear our bikinis. And then, you know, these intolerant backward cultures come in our country and tell us we have to cover fully up. So this also plays, right? You see, it turns the boundaries of toleration upside down in a way. It makes the narrative far more difficult to combat. But you get that a lot in Western Europe. In Central Eastern Europe, not so much, because what you have there is a different pattern. So you really have more ethnic nationalist conservative parties that have radicalized in government. And of course, in countries like Portugal or Greece, where I come from, again, because of the more conservative values, the far right tends to be a splinter of the center right sometimes, right? And so they tend to have more conservative, emphasize more conservative values.
There is a lot to unpack there, but it was such a complete answer. As you were, you know, in your answer, I was having questions and then you were answering them later on. So, but from the beginning of your answer, as you were explaining how we cannot speak of a typical far-right voter anymore, that's what I got from your answer. And in Portugal, that was extremely clear. And in the Netherlands, when the Geert Wilders gained, you know, became the first the most voted party, and in Portugal, 1 million people voted for Chega, the far-right party, out of 6 million. We cannot speak about a typical far-right voter anymore in this case, and also these different dimensions of where the parties come from, where they hail from, and to where they are now, and this the dichotomy between central Eastern Europe versus Western Europe. So I want to quote you. I have extracted this quote from one of your papers saying that there is no single success formula for right-wing populist parties. And indeed, what we have seen is, for example, again in the Netherlands, when the ruling party was trying to capitalize on an issue such as immigration, there was the issue of the far right. It resulted in a tremendous loss. So can we talk about issues as well of the far right? What dictates which issue is going to be capitalized by each party? Is it depending on what the voters, on the lack of, for example, if there is a hole of, in the sense of that mainstream parties are not giving attention to a specific issue and far-right parties capitalize on it? How do we also see this difference and variations among countries?
Yeah, so I think your question is a multifaceted question. So let me break it down if I can. So I think, to start with, as you probably have gathered already, the argument I'm putting forward is as much a supply side one as it is a demand side one, right? And so if you actually look at the salience of the immigration issue among voters, you see it's not the most salient issue. Obviously, salience changes, right? But if you look, I think last time I checked, many salient issues include inflation, the economy. Voters are concerned by a multitude of things, access to housing, etc. So immigration is sometimes, but not always, and not at the moment, the most salient issue. Really, if you look at it, in some cases, issues like immigration or attitudes towards Europe, for example, they have improved. So a lot of papers use this as a paradox. They call it the paradox of immigration, as you know, voters sometimes suggest that they are positive towards immigrants, or they have an extremely positive view of the European Union. And yet we see the rise of these parties at the same time. So how is this possible? Well, I think this is possible because we need to understand that, you know, political parties are not just receptors of the people, but they also shape voter attitudes themselves, as do the media, as do social media, as do we now with this podcast, right? So it's very much an interaction of demand and supply. So I think what's really going on there is, on the one hand, there is this issue, immigration, that far-right parties own, which in political science, we use this term to essentially mean that they are associated with this issue in the eyes of the voters. But they know better than we as academics, who sometimes fight, oh, it's about culture, oh, it's about economy, bickering, oh, my data shows this, my data shows that. Well, these parties know that this isn't the only problem that voters face. And so what they've tried to do is link immigration to every single other societal issue. So these parties are not single issue. They have policies for the economy, for welfare provision, for social services. It's just they link them all to immigration. So they say, okay, what's the problem? Schooling in your whatever area is problematic? No worries, we'll get rid of the immigrants. And do you have a housing issue? Is there an access problem to housing? No problem, we'll get rid of the immigrants. So they propose nationalist anti-immigrant solutions to all societal problems, but they do have a variety of other issues that they focus on, right? So welfare, for example, if you look at some of the data from the research I've done and other research as well, you'll see that their positions on welfare are becoming increasingly, you know, supportive of the welfare state. Not all, again, Chega is a bit different here, as is the AFD perhaps, as is the PVV. But overall, we see them focus more on welfare, but again, a welfare chauvinism, welfare only for our nation and for the policies that will help us expand our nation. So this is what's going on. And now the reason why the other parties are losing, we as academics try to, you know, sometimes advise parties and they won't always listen. The reason why they're losing is because when you increase the salience of the immigration issue as a mainstream party, for example, and then you say, oh, I've got a solution too, it doesn't work because the voter is going to go for the original and not for the copy. So what happens is you increase the salience. It's not that the voters themselves were so concerned about immigration. If you look at it, anti-immigrant parties are successful in constituencies that have low immigration levels. So very often it's people who don't have immigrants in their communities who vote anti-immigrant. Why is that? That is because the parties, the media, everybody talks a lot about immigration. You somehow convince people that all their problems are about immigration. And then, of course, you send them straight to the arms of the far-right parties that own the issue and therefore are the ones seen by the voters as credible. So it's a mistake. It's a strategic miscalculation on behalf of other parties to think that if they also talk about immigration, they're going to gain votes. They lose votes.
I think so if we do understand the voters of far-right parties mostly still as a protest vote, and we don't say this at all as a way of dismissing these voters who have very real grievances, but also in a sense, I think it's also a bit reassuring to think that, okay, most people are angry at mainstream parties and they don't, and the share of voters that indeed share the same ideology as far-right voters, it's quite small. So if we do keep this in mind, that most voters are still having a protest vote against the mainstream parties, what is it specifically about far-right parties that is so appealing to these distressed voters? Because in Portugal, we have had two main parties in power. So the real choices of voting are quite small, especially if you are from a district that realistically only elects one or two MPs from one or two parties. In the Netherlands, again, there's like several parties that enter parliament. So voters do have choices. So what is it about far-right parties? And perhaps here we can start touching about the role of social media and the role of the media in perhaps disseminating their message. So what is it about them and their appeal?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the voter, right? So as I said, there are voters that will vote for these parties because they're ideologically aligned. So for them, it's the narrative of getting limiting immigration, making our country great again, sovereignty. Okay. For others, it's a protest vote, it's an anti-vote. And for them, it's the ability of this party to put forward these multifaceted appeals while at the same time managing to shed the stigma that once made it unelectable, right? So in other words, a voter that may have had anti-immigrant attitudes in the past would not have voted for the Partido Nacional Renovador, because the Partido Nacional Renovador in Portugal, for those, I don't know if your audience is not necessarily from Portugal, so to explain, is the more extreme right variant that did exist during the economic crisis, but hardly got any votes, right? So a voter that has certain concerns about immigration and or is perhaps alienated economically, has concerns, insecurities, this voter is not going to go vote for the Partido Nacional Renovador because this sheds a stigma, because this is an extremist party, because your country has had a history of extremism like mine, or because in other countries, this is associated with extremism. But now you have a party that pretends to be mainstream, a party that pretends to be moderate, a party that calls itself populist. To us, I mean, to me as an academic, populism is not a good thing. But very often, to audiences, populism sounds like the people. So it sounds like there's a democratic element. They love to be called populist, right? So the voters will support parties that are not the establishment and yet are not stigmatized. Then it becomes a domino effect. You see the far right is doing well everywhere, and you're liberated as a voter, right? You think, fine, there is absolutely no stigma then. If the far right is doing well in the Netherlands, it came first, and in France, the Rassemblement National might become, might take the presidency. And in so many countries, we see it. Clearly, not all these voters are racist. Clearly, not all these voters are crazy. Clearly, not all these voters are extreme. Therefore, I can vote for it too. So in a way, it unleashes, it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And of course, you want to touch on the media and social media. This plays a massive role too, because unwillingly we normalize it, right? Unwillingly, when we platform it all the time, even if we want to talk about its perils, ultimately it's always the far right in the news. I mean, it's quite spectacular. I as I was chatting with you a bit earlier, I said, there's so many organizations that want to somehow address the far right, deal with the far right. They invite me to give talks and to participate in events. They're all something to do with combating the far right, addressing the far right, defeating the... So it's always the far right that leads and we follow. And that normalizes it. So again, it makes it really big in a way, you know? So at some point it starts, it just grows by itself. They just become big electoral competitors. And that's where we are now.
I see that. And that it makes much more sense now why we are, because it is what we are witnessing, a normalization of the far right and their narratives and their rhetoric. Whereas in 2019, when we last had elections the previous elections that we had in Portugal in 2019, Chega elected one MP to the parliament. And again, there was this stigma attached to it. People were not proud. There was very much of a secret if you voted for Chega. And here we are 5 years later, and they tripled their number compared to 2 years ago. It's the stigma is gone. They are new mainstream parties. And so, speaking of the real mainstream parties, are they then partly to blame for having been witness to this increase of the far right parties and maybe not listening to academics such as yourself who have studied this movement? Are they partly or at all to blame?
Let me rephrase this in a positive manner, right? Let me say instead. Let me say that yes, indeed. What I have been suggesting is that, you know, attitudes, they don't change that dramatically, right? Yes, I mean, voters have attitudes, but as you said, if you look at one election from another, there are countries where there are electoral competitions within 2 months from another. You know what? They didn't make government, so they had in Greece, for example, in the summer, and the results are vastly different. So clearly attitudes do not change within 2 years or 2 months, right? There's a supply side dimension to it, meaning the parties themselves and the competitors play an important role. So they have responsibility also for what's happening. But that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing because it means that we have agency to change it, right? If it's just a question of structure, then it would mean that our entire system is fundamentally and utterly flawed and that there is no solution, right? There will always be a far right and there's nothing we can do about it. But the fact that the other parties have responsibility to me means that we have agency to actually stop, you know, to actually do something to prevent the far right from becoming more successful. And I think that responsibility lies with the mainstream parties, both of the left and the right. And in a way, I think unwillingly, I think what political parties want is success, right? What they want is votes. Sometimes it's very common in party competition to think, well, if my competitor is doing this and they're doing it well, then I need to copy them. So it's a strategy that makes sense opportunistically, but in reality, as I said in the beginning, is actually a flawed strategy. It does not yield the desired results. So I do think that political actors can change that, and I do hope that they would listen more and look at a series of research findings that are out. And I think, again, you know, a few years ago, we didn't have that much. We did have a few people working on it, of course, but now findings have proliferated, and I'm not the only one saying that, right? So I think it does show that there is something we can do to change this. And this is stop normalizing the far right.
I do believe there is a serious reckoning to be done if we are allowing in democracy to have these far right parties who, to a certain extent, threaten democracy itself, the fundamentals of democracy, the system that we've been building. And for my last question, perhaps it's time for a history lesson. I mean, are we seeing a repeat of what happened in Europe in the 1930s? I mean, keep in mind that the Hitler's and the Salazar, our dictator in Portugal, they were elected via democratic means, and then surely but steadily they managed to erode democracy that had been built. Are we seeing a repeat? Are we back to where we were a century ago?
I would really love to say no, right? But I think you're right in that indeed these voters, many far-right dictatorships were indeed elected. Many were indeed supported by lots and lots of people, right? And that's, again, that gives you the idea of how this populism that may sound democratic is actually not as democratic as you think. The idea that we, you know, talking about the people doesn't necessarily allude to democracy. But I would also like to hope that since this is a lesson, I think part of what we're seeing as well is, I think, a bit of a we don't have memory. Do you know what I mean? I think the generation of the Second World War generations are dying out, and we don't really have memory. And because of the normalization of these parties, we're voting for them, I guess, in a way, thinking this couldn't happen. This is not what this is. That's not how it's going to go. But indeed, a bit of reckoning and a bit of taking in the lesson from what happened, we can't stop it. And I don't think we should stop these parties from running, right? Because that's undemocratic too, right? They can run, but I think we shouldn't do coalitions with them. And I think, you know, I don't think other parties should copy them. And I think other parties need to compete on their own issues, maintain their own ideological cohesion, and run and do what it is they do best. And then maybe we can actually substantively and properly compete with the far right and phase it out of our democratic systems, not because we deplatformed it, because I think that will backfire, right? If you completely not allow them to run, these are okay, you know, they're not violent parties anymore. So you can't do that. This will have a backlash, but just let them phase out because their policy proposals are no longer viable in actually properly functioning democracies. And just to say, I mean, we do know that in many cases where these parties are in government, like Hungary, for example, they have made significant attempts to erode liberal democratic institutions and to make constitutional changes designed to outlast them. So in a way, changes that even if the government of the day goes, these changes will stay because they're constitutional and very, very difficult to get rid of. So it is indeed liberal democracy that's at stake. Not just one party getting a few votes at some point. So I think it requires a huge amount of responsibility, both on behalf of the voters and on behalf of the other competitive parties, about what the implications are for our democracies and what we can do to stop it.
Daphne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for staying on that side and listening to my conversation with Daphne Alicchiopolo, Chair in Comparative Politics at the University of York. Today, we answered the question, how did we get here, and looked at how the far right came to own the issue of immigration. Next week, we zoom in Germany as a case study of the rise of the far right. If you want to be notified right away when the next episode is published, don't forget to subscribe to Friends of Europe's podcast wherever you get your podcast to never miss an episode of Policy Voices. As always, we would love to hear what you thought of today's episode. You can search for Friends of Europe on LinkedIn and X or send us an email. Our address is press@friendsofeurope.org. I'm Caterina Villanova, and I will be with you again next week. Until then, goodbye.